Welcome to the Eclipse Wealth Podcast. This is your guide to making sense of financial planning and wealth management. It's brought to you by Eclipse Private Office and is here to inform, inspire confidence, and spark ideas that help you take control of your financial future. In each episode, we'll explore the key concepts that drive long-term success. Everything from building a strong foundation to making those all-important decisions as your wealth grows. You'll hear from experienced professionals who live and breathe this work every day, and from private investors who'll share what they've learned on a path to financial freedom. Our first series is called The Client Journey. Each episode takes you through a different stage of the financial planning process, helping you see what's ahead and, more importantly, what's possible. So whether you're just getting started or well on your way, there's something here for you. Let's begin the journey.
Hello. We are walking up the slopes of financial accumulation on our quest for financial freedom. This is probably the longest leg of the client journey, so we've decided to divide it into two episodes, starting with a theoretical discussion before we move on to practical aspects next time. So today I'm delighted to introduce you to two new guests. Nick Marshall is a fund manager with Peregrine and Black in London, where he runs their model portfolios, and 10 years later, he's still doing an excellent job there. He also contributes his knowledge and expertise to the investment committee across the wider business at Peregrine and Black. My second guest studied economics at university before embarking on a career in investments. He is James Clark, a senior fund analyst with a background in private client investment management and well-versed in managing buy lists of collective funds. He has also managed model portfolio services for some well-known firms, where he also co-founded and developed a sustainable investment proposition. James also featured in the Citywire Wealth Managers Top 100 Fund Selectors in the UK in both 2020 and 2021. My name is Max Weatherby, and together we're discussing financial accumulation and the eighth wonder of the world. So Nick, many of our listeners will be first-time investors, and it may be obvious to some, but can you please start us off by giving them a definition of investment?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Max, and thanks for having me on the podcast. And good to see you again, James. I've got a fair bit to cover, so I didn't get the dictionary definition for this. But quite simply, if you ask me the most basic definition, it's deploying your capital in the hope or in order to make a profit. And that capital could be investing in a myriad of things. In this case, I'm guessing we're going to focus on financial products as opposed to investing in wine or cars or houses. But it's quite simply deploying your capital, usually disposable income, as in money you've got to spare, and then hoping, depending on how long or where you invest it, that you come back with a profit.
James, got anything else to add to that?
Firstly, Max, thanks for having me. My podcast debut, so I'm very pleased to be here. Definition of investment, I'd say an asset acquired to gain capital appreciation or generate an income over time, something that requires the outlay of a resource today for a greater payoff in future.
That's a pretty good definition, I think, from both of you there.
Yep.
Let's make it sort of practical, if you like, to start off with. And say our listener finds him or herself with a sum of £1,000 that is surplus to their current needs. What are their choices, basically, in basic terms? James?
So I'd say in basic terms, Max, I think we have current consumption, i.e. spending it now, or deferred consumption. And I think by that, we're really talking in reality about lending it or investing it. Perhaps to quote an economist's answer, perhaps what an economist's answer would be, we're talking about investment being the acquisition of goods that are not consumed in the current period, but are used in the future to produce other goods and services.
And Nick, is there much more to add?
The economist there has covered that rather well for my liking. Yes. But from a practical note, let's go lending. If you asked to borrow £100 off me on a Saturday night, I could say, fine, no problem, pay me back on Monday morning.
Yeah.
If you said, can I borrow 1,000 for 6 months? Then it'd be a different conversation.
Yeah.
So if I'm giving my £1,000 to the bank on deposit, if I'm investing it in something, I expect a premium or to get rewarded for, as James said, deferring my consumption of said £1,000.
That's a good point, and I think we'll come on to that later on. Let's stick with our listener with that sort of £1,000 or so. If they're putting off their immediate gratification, because of course they could go out and spend it, they can go out and buy something today, whatever that might be. But in investing it in an asset or something, they're surely expecting some sort of compensation for doing so. And I wonder, James, whether this is the moment where we reveal what I said was the eighth wonder of the world.
Okay, as good a time as any, Max. So I think we're at the point of introducing compound interest to our listeners. And I think if we take the example of simple interest versus compound interest. So simple interest is a simple calculation of interest, funnily enough. So if we take the example of investing £1,000 at a rate of return of 5% a year over 3 years, then if looking at simple interest, you'd say, okay, £50 a year of interest over 3 years, £150 total interest. Compound interest, on the other hand, is, to quote one definition, the interest on a loan or deposit that is added to the previous balance, which in turn increases the interest paid in the following period. So in essence, you're earning interest on interest. And so it compounds over time, hence the name compound interest. So in this £1,000, 5%, 3 year example that I used, if you look at that in terms of compound interest, the total interest earned is £157.63, which is actually 5.1% greater than the simple interest if it were accrued on that basis. So you can see the difference in just a very simple example in a short period of time. And one can imagine how that really compounds over time, and particularly if you're talking about greater investment amounts.
Yeah, I've got some examples I'll share with you in a minute later. Nick, I know this is something you wanted to comment on as well.
I'll give you a bit of Warren Buffett, because everyone likes a bit of Buffett, and there's going to be far too many quotations today. But essentially, my wealth has come from a combination of living in America, some lucky genes, and compound interest. And reiterating what James said, it's just investing interest on interest. And the longer you do that for, the more your initial sum is, exponentially, those numbers become exceptionally interesting if you work in our world, and exceptionally rewarding if you're the investor.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was actually Albert Einstein who allegedly said that, and I couldn't help using it in the title of this podcast to lure people to listen to us. Whether he said it or not, I don't know, but it is a good quote. I certainly remember when I first really got compound interest, it clicked with me. But Nick, do you remember the time when you first got it?
I do, and I stumbled across it. And I will caveat this, that this was before I worked in finance, before everyone gets very worried that I'm a head of model portfolio solutions. I won't mention any fund names today because it's not really a promotion. But I bought a well-known income fund, and I'm going back quite a few years now. And income being topical, of course, it's all about the dividend yield. And I didn't realize at the time that there were two different share prices, or as we call them, units you could buy. And one was substantially higher than the other. So that immediately piqued my interest. When I checked them out, one was called an income share class, one was called an accumulation share class. Being from the North, my initial reaction was I want to buy the cheaper one. But then when I sat down and did the maths in Excel, I then realized, hang on a sec, and a couple of friends of mine said, oh, it's called compounding. And I ran some numbers with some basic Excel skills, just like James was talking there, really. And 5% over 10 years with a 1,000 investment or a 10,000 investment, and the difference at the end of year 10. And I suddenly realized, now we do have different requirements in our role because some of our clients have income requirements. So we have to match those liabilities, as we'd call them. Given the choice in my world of if you have disposable income, I would always go for the compounding approach or the accumulation approach. And I think even actually with my investing, I tend to prefer growth companies which reinvest their capital to expand. I've always had more of a passion for emerging markets and places like that.
James, do you remember the time you first came across compound interest, or was it at university?
I think it would have been after that, Max. I think for me, it was when studying for my exams at my first firm in the industry. In the office, we had a dusty, unused room, which we referred to as the room of gloom, where all the younger people went into to do a bit of studying, perhaps early in the morning or in the evening after work. So I think it would have been when reading a CISI textbook in the room of gloom.
I'm a little bit older than both of you. And so I was doing this sort of stuff before sort of Excel sort of spreadsheets. And I started off as a property guy. And really, it was when I was doing learning about valuation property. And of course, in commercial property, what you're doing is you're valuing different interests. It could be a freeholder or a leaseholder, and looking at it purely from an investment point of view. And we had this old book of formulas and things to look it up, because as I said, didn't have Excel back then, and known as Parry's Tables. And you could look it up, a bit like the log tables you had back at school if you were of that era as well. And no, shaking their heads there. I'm the old guy here. And I remember doing some of the calculations, and as I had been told to do, and scratching my head. And so I've always been enamored with this basic formula, and it is this. It's 1 plus I to the power of N, where 1 is your principal, I is the rate of interest that you're going to charge, and N is the number of years over which you're compounding. And it's that very simple formula that when you apply it, gives you these exponential returns. And I remember checking my calculations several times because I just couldn't quite get it. But today you can do it very simply in an Excel spreadsheet, or else you can get Google or AI to do it for you. But just when you look at the numbers, and I've just run some basic ones today, and I've looked at a basis of actually if our listener was to put aside £100 each month, what they could do with that. Now, £100 a month, that might be what you're spending on coffee, that latte or cappuccino every day at work. You could be spending £100 a month on that quite easily. Suppose you were to defer that and not have that, make your own if you like, and what might happen with that? And the numbers really are quite interesting. We have to be careful about using different rates of interest that are there, putting numbers that we can't necessarily substantiate. But I've run some numbers here. James gave you some basic ones early on. If you were to invest £100 each month over a three-year period, you'd be shelling out £3,600. And if you were to be able to invest that at 7% per annum, I'm not saying you are, but suppose you were, then that future level would then be £3,993. Over 5 years, that sum would reach £7,159. Over 10 years, £17,000. Over 15 years, £31,696. That's a hell of a lot of coffee. And I think it is informative. If one was to increase that on a inflation basis, if you like, suppose you were able to start with £100 and then you were to increase it each year by 5%, which is pretty modest escalation of inflation, then that goes up quite substantially. In fact, in 3 years' time, that £100 would be £115 a month that you're paying out. Over 5 years, it'd be £127 and so forth. But the point being, taking that indexation effect, if you were to increase that in line with a 5% escalator, those figures over 3 years would end up being £3,875 as opposed to £3,000. And over 10 years, you would have a sum of over £15,000. So let's not get too, I don't want to get too bogged down in the numbers, but you can start to see how it actually starts. It really does become very meaningful. So I do encourage listeners to play around with that, play the numbers. Nick?
Yeah, I think it's probably worth echoing here. We're talking about 3, 5, and 10 years. That's the world that we live in and the world that we operate in when it comes to investing. So we're very much not focusing on perhaps some of the more short-termism that you get and day trading. That's not all we do. So when we look for our clients, look for ourselves, I, to be fair, start from 3 years. So medium to long term, some of my investments I've held for 10, 15. This job's approaching 10 years. Some of those funds have been in there for 10 years. So whilst we talk about the power of compounding, for us, it's a real issue because we tend to hold things for 3, 5, and 10. So that's why we've used those metrics to illustrate.
That's a really good point. When we're saying we're investing, as investors, we are looking at the long term. Someone who's just messing about, they're really traders and trading, and that's not what any of us do. So I think that's an important distinction to make to our listeners. James?
Just reflecting on your numbers there, Max, it should be clear to everybody that those numbers really do add up over time. If you can invest at an attractive rate, keep that going over, as Nick says, 3, 5, 7, 10 years, it really does add up. And this is the power of compound interest that we're talking about today. Well worth harnessing.
Absolutely. Let's move the conversation. Each of us talked about how compound interest works. But Nick, perhaps you can explain some of the reasons an investor expects to be compensated for delaying consumption, for not going out and blowing £1,000 on a new pair of trainers and a meal out, but instead actually invested it. What are the ways that they can be compensated?
In terms of how you get compensated and why you would expect to get paid more, James can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the opportunity cost of capital. So what can I do with my £1,000? If I put it in the bank, let's not get overly bogged down with this, but it's a risk-free rate, I could get 3.5%. So if I'm going to lend you my money, I want to get more than 3.5%. If I lend you my money, that pesky thing called inflation, my £100, I'm going to need £103 just to pay the rent and my pint of Guinness when I go down the pub. So I factor both of those things in, and that's what investors should be doing. And also the duration of the risk and how long I'm lending you the money for. I don't know what's going to happen for you in a year or 3 years. So there's all sorts of moving parts, and that's the expected rate of return in our world. I deal with the investments, as you know, but for our private client managers, sometimes they have to dampen those expected rate of returns from clients because they're not justifiable. But as a starting point, you should be looking to beat inflation and the risk-free rate, which is give or take a 10-year treasury bond in America or 10-year gilt in the UK.
James, obviously there are some other specific risks out there for investors. Is there anything you want to pick up on particularly?
Nick's covered inflation risk, all sorts of different types of market risk. Depends what you're investing in. Stock specific is a risk as well. That's a whole different can of worms. But there's all sorts of different categories of risk that investors could be exposed to and quite rightly expect to be compensated for.
Some of our younger listeners are probably not used to inflation. For most of their life, it hasn't really been a problem, unless you look at the last 2 years or so, when it really has. And I think, Nick, you mentioned purchasing power, and certainly the sort of purchasing power of £100 a year ago is somewhat diminished today. You've only got to go into a grocery store to work that one out. So that's an important part for our consideration for our investors, isn't it? What are some of the ways that investors can look to mitigate from those sorts of, particularly from inflation? Are there some specific areas that tend to be more inflation hedges than others?
I'm happy to go on the fun side for a bit on that, if you want, Max. Yeah. You're looking at something where the cost is paid by you, unfortunately. It's passed on to the consumer. Now, we all get water bills, we all get gas bills, right? They're called utilities, regulated utilities. With the exception of Thames Water, which has a few company issues, one would argue that my Thames water bill has gone up, my gas bill has gone up, and I have to pay it. And it's gone up in line with inflation. So they would be classified or classed as inflation-protected assets. More generally, equities tend to do quite well, so they're known as a good hedge against inflation. But if I put all those utilities in a bucket into a fund, which is what I buy, you would be looking at a theme called infrastructure.
Yeah.
So again, no names, but the infrastructure I invest in has the safe stuff in regulated assets and then has a sub-bucket in what's called user pays. So toll roads, ports, airports, you're still going to pay to go on your holiday. If you've got a big cargo boat, you still got to dock it to get rid of your oil or your gas. So those are a couple of examples and themes that you can use to hedge against inflation.
Yeah, that might be a good point to leave on to us. To each of us is responsible to a greater or lesser extent of investing near millions on behalf of clients. But remembering that we're on the client journey here and thinking of our first-time investor again, James, just bring it back to sort of basics, if you like. What are the sort of basic choices our investor has with his £1,000 or perhaps £5,000 as a lump sum to go out and invest?
So if we return to the idea of deferred consumption and we're talking about either lending or investing, for the purposes of our chat today, I think if we look beyond lending, because I think in reality, you'd probably need a formal agreement or contract with the person, with your counterparty, if you like. That's probably more in theory than in reality. We're talking about investment. I think for a first-time investor with a modest sum to invest, I think you could be looking at a multi-asset fund or perhaps investing into a model portfolio service. For a multi-asset fund, you're looking at one fund to own, or possibly a combination of two or three. But for simplicity, let's just say one, where that fund can invest in bonds, equities, and alternatives such as infrastructure that Nick mentioned, commercial property, and the likes of gold as well. So another strand on inflation protection, other things to mention would be index-linked government bonds, where the coupons are indexed to a particular measure of inflation. Equities, where some companies have revenue streams implicitly linked to inflation. Commercial property, likewise, rental income implicitly linked to inflation. Gold, slightly different. You're talking more about scarcity value, source of value, a hedge against disasters. So gold's slightly different. But a multi-asset fund can give you simple access to a number of different types of assets. And for the modest potential sums that we're talking about here, could be a really good option. Simple structure, one manager or team taking care of asset allocation for the investor. And the investor can, as I say, just own one or possibly two or three funds. And that's a good simple option.
Max, not to hijack the title of the podcast, completely wholeheartedly agree with everything James said there. And if you want to talk about the power of compounding, I think the bigger excitement is the power of diversification, which is exactly what James has just said. You can compound all you want, but if you're not diversified, you can also compound negatively. So diversification is what we do, it's what we live and breathe.
Yeah.
So we're both going to say multi-asset and models because that's what we've grown up on.
That's very true. And I think, obviously, in a multi-asset fund, someone's making those decisions in terms of allocating between things. And we haven't really got time on this session to talk about asset allocation in this particular episode. But since you mentioned funds, let's for now assume that our investor takes financial advice, goes to see an IFA, and puts his or her nest egg of £5,000 into a collective fund of, say, UK shares. Let's keep it at that for discussion purposes. In a collective fund of UK shares, so what are the underlying holdings in such a fund? And perhaps you dive into the food chain there of what's actually going on, what's happening to their money when it's in there. James, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, of course. So I think we are talking about a basket of publicly traded UK companies listed on the London Stock Exchange. Generally, we'd be talking about very large UK companies with market capitalizations. So that's the share count in issue multiplied by the share price. So market capitalizations in the tens or perhaps hundreds of billions of pounds. So we're talking about very large companies here. So, for example, well-known supermarkets, consumer goods manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, oil and gas companies, that kind of thing. So a fund offers a diversified portfolio of companies, as opposed to handpicking one or two companies and buying those shares directly. So to return to Nick's point, diversification is a real benefit here. Allied with that, you can, by buying a fund, effectively employ the services of a professional fund manager to help you, as well as the administrative oversight offered by that fund management group. Furthermore, there's all sorts of different options here. So in terms of style, you could have a growth-oriented UK companies fund. You could have a value-oriented fund. You could have income orientation, sustainability, smaller companies rather than very large companies. There's all sorts of different flavors available, effectively. Lots of different options out there, but lots of very good options out there. And furthermore, what this investment is really doing is providing capital to these companies. And that's in return for the prospect of capital appreciation over time and or income generation.
That's a good point. And I guess that's the reason to get independent financial advice, isn't it? Because, of course, there is a lot of choice out there. And it's far better to get advice on what's appropriate than play eeny, meeny, miny, mo on that basis. And I think a lot of first-time investors don't actually understand what being a shareholder actually involves or means. And clearly, as a holder within a fund, you're one or two steps removed from that. But nonetheless, I think it's important to mention to people what the basic rights of a shareholder are. You mentioned that it might be invested in a major supermarket, major consumer goods company. We're all customers of these businesses. But what does it actually mean to be a shareholder of a big business like that, albeit within a fund?
It's different within a fund because the fund manager pretty much sweeps up all the share allocation and he gets to not enjoy the benefits. You're allowed to go to the AGM and you get a free ham sandwich. There you go. But you've also got voting rights. That's slightly more important.
Yeah.
And what you will find is some of these big institutions, BlackRock, JP Morgan, they might be the major shareholders in a big company. Now, if the three of us bought a share in a very small company, we might get to 1% of it. Amusingly or anecdotally, I believe if you haven't done the textbooks for a long time, if you get to 3%, we'll be notifying the London Stock Exchange. And if we get to 30%, we'll have to bid for the entire company. Now, we're not going to hit that. We're not going to hit those dizzying heights.
No, we're not.
But if you're an institutional shareholder where thousands of us are invested in that fund, you might find that you're holding 10, 15, 20%. And you can have shareholders voting down various strategies, various remuneration to the board. And that is, it's in our news quite a lot at the moment, more in something called investment trusts, where you have activist investors. So it is slightly more than just getting paid the dividend. You actively participate in the profits of said company. And beyond that, you hope that the fund manager and their company are good with, this is probably one more for James, with stewardship and getting involved with what the company does. Its corporate backdrop, if you like.
I think one thing that will be interesting to some of our listeners, certainly to the sort of custom group that I often refer to, is what James mentioned earlier, and that is sustainability, investing in companies like that. And I think certainly that's an important point to make to some listeners, that they do have some choice if they have ethical considerations. Do you want to say a bit more about that, James?
Yeah, of course, Max. There's been a real boom since around 2017, 2018 in sustainable investment. A tougher time over the last few years, but there was a real boom. And there's a lot of choices out there for investing sustainably across all different types of assets. So from fixed income through equities and into alternative assets, albeit the choice is a bit thinner on the ground in alternative assets. And it's not just a case of avoiding doing harm. There are some real positive investment opportunities out there and impact-oriented investments as well, whereby, as well as a financial gain, fund managers are actively trying to make a positive impact with what they're doing and evidence that as well and report that to investors. So there are sustainable investment services out there that invest in sustainable funds, but also can also invest directly as well in the likes of bonds and equities that pass muster according to their own sustainable processes. And there's a whole subsection of the industry around this. And as I say, there was a real boom and it's been a little bit tougher over the last couple of years, but I do hope it's poised to come back into the good times.
Yeah, a lot of things fall in and out of favour, don't they, for all sorts of reasons. But I think we have been talking about a fund and been talking about hypothetically investing into a UK equities fund. And of course, the value of investments can rise as well as fall. We have to say that at some point during this podcast. And we all know that share prices go up and go down. But in terms of the holder of said fund, if they notice the price of shares going down, say, in some of the holdings, how does that show up in that fund held by our listener?
Ultimately, the price I will get would be the price of the fund at the end of the day. That could consist of 50 underlying holdings. Now, we do slightly more than just watch the share price at the end of the day, I can assure you. We get all the research that we need, and a lot of that stuff will hopefully highlight to us that the retail sector is in trouble, or healthcare has some great news maybe coming out vis-a-vis pricing and products and new drugs. Then we would go back and just check our portfolios, our fund managers, and see what their exposure is to said areas and also to said stocks. Because one thing we didn't highlight before was we employ active managers. So if they like pharmaceuticals, they're probably going to pick Glaxo over Astra or Astra over Glaxo. It makes no difference to me. They've got 20 analysts. They run a very big, successful company and fund. But I will probably be aware if one of those said pharma companies came out with a profits warning or the analysts thought it was looking pretty bad for them. So even though we only get the share price of the fund we've invested in, let's keep with the income theme and call it an income fund, we also know exactly where our fund manager is investing. We pay that money for him to actively choose stocks for outperformance and to actively take on the sector weightings in the index. If he can do both, great. Historically, the asset allocation adds more value than the stock selection. But ultimately, that's what we're looking for. And equally, if there was something horrible that happened as one of his stocks or her stocks, we would expect an update very quickly because information's key. If James and I are running a portfolio with 17 fund managers in there with 50 stocks each, that's a lot to cover. So we rely on the information. And indeed, one of my tenets is I won't invest in a fund manager, regardless of how good they are, if I don't get information on tap and up to speed.
Yeah, good point. This talk of prices rising and falling provides a perfect segue, I think, into the behavior of crowds. History has some salutary lessons for all of us and some good stories too. Nick, I wonder if you'd care to start us off.
Yeah, I'm going to go back in time. I'm going to sadly be showing my age now because this example is allegedly the first example of a financial bubble or mania recorded in history. And would you believe it involves flowers, it involves tulips, or specifically tulip bulbs, to be exact. And it was in 1634. So we're going back a little bit here. And what happened, in essence, they were a sought-after item. They became very popular. The crowd piled in and exhibited everything we now know through behavioral finance, which is atypical or typical of a bubble. And consequently, the prices went stratospheric. Now, again, I can't plagiarize, so I will source Wikipedia here. It's actually a very good article. I really enjoyed it. They actually gave a list of what one ship was willing to exchange for a tulip bulb. But I don't know how much lard was involved in whatever measurement they used. There were 8 fat oxen and a couple of swine. But I finally found something practical, which was 10,000 guilders, which, irrespective of going back to 1634, I couldn't tell you the exchange rate and I can't adjust it. 10,000 guilders would get you, according to Wikipedia, a luxury canal house with staff and stables and an 80-foot garden.
Wow.
10,000 guilders, one tulip bulb, or a luxury house with an 80-foot garden with stables and servants. So that's how bad it got. And then it became so speculative. Everyone was just buying them off each other. And it was forward contracting because they're flower bulbs. You can't buy them every day. It just got to the point where it became so expensive. Everyone went, we're not paying that. And that's when the euphoria and then the panic. And then that's when it dropped like a stone and it dropped over 90%. And there are a lot of people who obviously got in at the end, which is the dangerous aspect of a bubble. So I think it's interesting because it's one of the earlier ones. Some of the data is a bit hard to collate, but it's still good for an anecdote. And in terms of why it's relevant today, again, too many quotations, but history does not repeat itself, but it does often rhyme, which I believe is, again, applied to Mark Twain, we're not sure. And there's far more examples from 1634 of said bubbles. And I'm not going to start a conversation on this one. But at the end of the article, there's a quote from the president of the Dutch Central Bank in 2013. I'll try and pronounce his name, but I'll get it wrong. Knut Velnik. And he's talking about Bitcoin, which again, we're not going down the rabbit hole, but Bitcoin, he said, it is worse than tulip mania. At least then you got a tulip. Now you get nothing. So it just proves the history doesn't repeat, but does rhyme. And I think James is going to give another more recent example of even though we've learnt from the past, you can still get euphoria and bubbles and manias.
Yeah, it's human nature, isn't it? James, what have you got to share with us?
Well, Max, I've got a more recent example, perhaps not technically a bubble, arguable, debatable, but almost certainly an example of the behaviour of crowds. And if we can refer to a recent example of sustainable investing, as I said earlier, there was a real boom in sustainable investing. And if we look particularly at the period of 2019 to 2021. There are some examples to be shared here. In the middle of 2021, 90% of inflows into UK domiciled investment funds were of a sustainable nature. That's massive. It was really very popular. It was definitely the flavor of the month, if not the year or a couple of years. And there are a few companies that were arguably poster children for this underlying investment. So sustainable investment funds would be owning the equity of companies such as a very well-known electric car manufacturer, a pretty well-known manufacturer of home exercise bikes and associated kit, and a Danish company that is the world's largest developer of offshore wind power. And to use this latter example, this company's share price in 2019 rose by 55%. In 2020, it doubled. And then it came off in 2021, down 38% that year. And what happened towards the end of this period was that some valuations reached really quite heady levels. The stocks had been very popular. And as I say, valuations had really run up to some quite high levels, difficult to justify. And then they came off as some investors sold and were questioning those valuation levels. So another aspect that contributed to the end of this was inflation coming back into the picture that you referred to earlier, Max. So to return to the start, debatable whether it's a bubble. It was certainly a very popular period, but there's a few examples of the kind of behavior of crowds that we're talking about.
Interesting. Thank you both for those. It's good to have. Unfortunately, there's no shortage of stories, and it's always interesting to hear them and remind ourselves again. And with all these tales, I hope that we haven't put our listeners off completely. But there is one more story that I'd probably like to share, and that's the tale that goes back to Charles Ponzi. Although his name is given to this, it was certainly not the first example. And Charles Ponzi was a con artist operating in the 1920s in America, and he gave his name to what I'm about to tell you, which is a Ponzi scheme is generally when a con artist offers investors a high return with perhaps little or no risk at all. And these are often said to come from a business or something that may not exist at all. And what happens basically is that the con artist generally pays out the early investors that which is promised. So everyone gets very excited. And of course, he uses the money coming in from the later investors whilst creaming off a nice fat return for himself or herself. These things carry on until they burn out. And basically, when the music stops, we all find out what's really going on. They inevitably do. And there are lots of examples of this, sadly, around today. In our world, there was an investment Ponzi scheme some years ago run by a gentleman called Bernie Madoff. That's worthwhile looking up on Wikipedia, if you can do. But in essence, it's basically what they do is they rob Peter to pay Paul. So I think caveat emptor is something that we should all be aware of, whether we're a first-time investor or an experienced investor, as we are. So I think that's probably enough tales for one session. And the risk of stating the obvious, investing clearly carries some risk. Nick, you've mentioned some of it already, but just to recap perhaps again, some of the ways that investors can mitigate those risks. I'm thinking again of our first-time investor with his or her nest egg or £5,000.
I think from a practical standpoint, as you've mentioned, we've covered it really, seek professional advice. You can do your own research. You can use a number of different ways to access buying funds and stocks and shares. But it comes back to the power of diversification to use that again. That really is probably the biggest tool in the arsenal when it comes to safeguard. You can't completely safeguard investments. That's why you have risk warnings left and center. But certainly, put simply, looking over the years running a diversified portfolio, what tends to happen is you will get laggards, but the others will pick up the slack. And when something's not in vogue, other things will kick in. So rather than, as we all do, look at the best performing fund out of all 17 and go, I should be making, that's the opposite and counterintuitive to what we have to focus on. For us, it's what's not doing too well. Why do we hold it in the portfolio? Do we need to move it? So whilst we rely on our managers to actively outperform, we also, James and I, have to actively change. If a manager leaves, we have to change our allocation to different asset classes. And generally speaking, this is a gross simplification. If you get it right more than you get it wrong, you'll outperform little by little. And guess what? Compounded over time, that's quite a powerful message.
Certainly is. James, anything to add to that?
No, I think that's great. Very happy to leave that one there. Good, very good point, Nick.
I'm looking at the clock and thinking we've probably been enjoying ourselves too much. But I think for our listeners, perhaps we can leave them with some homework. And I've asked you each to come up with a good book recommendation. Hopefully nothing too taxing. But so what would be a good book, Nick?
I've gone controversial. So I'm just going to go with the film being a bit more modern and younger. And I think for those who aren't in finance, you can do worse than listen to Margot Robbie and Selena Gomez in The Big Short explaining to you about the housing crisis. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very good adaptation of what is a very, sadly, not only a complex subject, but what we were all directly involved with, managing money. And we didn't see it coming. It was subprime mortgage market. But I just thought the film, that was a modernization. He'd had a couple of other Hollywood ones, but yeah. that crossed the divide. It was very informative and it was also very watchable as well. Yeah, is it Michael Lewis who wrote the book, The Big Short, I think it's called? Yeah, that's what I would suggest. Oh yeah, I'll be modern and go for the video adaptation.
Great choice there. James, what do you got for us?
Max, mine's only loosely related to investment, but as soon as I saw the question come up, I immediately thought of Prisoners of Geography by Tim Marshall. There's a series of three or four books. This is the first one, in my opinion, the original and best. And it's really all about how countries' geography is related to their geopolitics and their economies as well. I thought I'd rustle up just a couple of stats for you. This book's full of interesting stats. The first one is that in the US, the Greater Mississippi Basin, so that's between the Appalachians and the Rockies, has more miles of navigable rivers than the rest of the world combined, which is really important because it enabled a lot of trade in the fledgling US. And then on Russia, the first chapter of this book is on Russia. Obviously, the continental divide in the middle of Russia, the Ural Mountains between Asia and Europe. 75% of Russia's territory is in Asia, but only 22% of its population lives there. So in the western section, Moscow and lots of other large cities, 25% of Russia's land contains 78% of its population. Really good book, very interesting stuff.
Well, I don't know that one, so I'm going to go and get it straight away. So it's something to read to. I'm going to go very old school and recommend a book that was written a long time ago. It's a classic, if you like. It is about investing, but it's also not about investing. And it's called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. It was very American, but also very profound, I think. So you can get hold of a copy, probably secondhand copy for next to nothing on Amazon or your secondhand bookshop. But it's generally worth reading as a primer before reading anything else. I think we've climbed a long way up the virtual slopes of financial accumulation in this session, and perhaps this is a good moment to halt this leg of the journey. I hope you agree it's been a fascinating discussion, and I want to thank our guests and storytellers, Nick Marshall of Peregrine & Black, and investment analyst James Clark. Next time, we shall continue the climb with two more professional guests who shall provide a more practical take on the concepts that we've discussed today. For now, goodbye.
If you enjoyed listening to this section of the Client Journey series, then why not subscribe and listen to past and future episodes? You can find out more on our website at www.eclipsewealth.co.uk/podcast. Eclipse Private Office is a trading style of Peregrine & Black Investment Management Limited, who are authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority here in the UK. Please remember that this podcast is for educational and information purposes only. We are not advising whether a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can go down as well as up, and past performance of an investment is not a predictor of future returns. However, if you are interested in discussing any of the topics raised, then please contact Peregrine & Black via our website to arrange to speak with an independent financial advisor. Thanks again for listening, and be sure to join us next time for more conversation along the client journey.